SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
They're fine and stable, and you don't have a problem. And I don't. Anyway, so I'm doing it from home because there's too much. There's too many. Actually, number of calls to make. So Anna Seitz is going to join us, and Nicole Russo, I imagine, too, probably after Sid. And, of course, Sid will have some thoughts as well. But $2.4 million for the session topper, the Into Mischief colt that the Y Gods, who have really – it's really been a all year long between daughter Emily Bushnell and the horse that she and Rick Waldman campaigning, and then their breeding operation. It's been a big year on the racetrack and under gavel, and the Speedway stable team, and Marette Farrell and Zoe Cadman. Should really reach out to Zoe, and they bring home that Into Mischief colt. They most often everybody says we expected to pay that much. They Marette made it very clear we really didn't want to pay that much, but right? I love that. But Jesus, we really didn't want to pay $2.3 million, $2.4 million. We were more comfortable at 1.7. At that point, what's the right? What's another $600,000 or $700,000? it was just unbelievable. I mean, the horses that we talked about yesterday with Jessica, and kind of made the suggestion that they were going to break sharp from the gate, and boy, that was really the case, because Mr. Rigney. Right early on, $975,000 for the Medaglia d'Oro Princess Julia filly right away. And then I think it was the next hip, right? That Pure Clan filly I mentioned, the big family. Mandy Pope pounced. And obviously, not only racing prospect, the gun runner out of Pure Clan, but down the road, she'll be a big time broodmare prospect when the time's right for Mandy. You had another Coolmore Brandt top level partnership purchase, and that was the Gun Runner. Fairly early too. That was in the first hour and 15 minutes, maybe hour and change. Another Gun Runner, $1.9 million. Godolphin jumped in. And, it's funny. I want you to, when you're talking and having the kind of conversation we had yesterday with Boyd Browning, things pop in your head. And as an interview subject is talking, and you go off in one direction or another. And one thing I was going to ask him was, the absence of Godolphin, and they jumped in last night, bought a Justify colt that Hunter Valley had offered $1 million, hip 174. Anybody that, if you're watching the Godolphin operation these days, I mean, they've sort of reached I could bring this up with Sid, almost kind of a maturity station in development. I mean, the vast majority now, are homebreds, and obviously they got access to any stallion they want, and they're broodmare band. So Godolphin, though, jumping in for a Justify out of Dolce Limon, $1 million. So six more $1 million hips. What didn't I mention? John Stewart, $1.2 million for the Ghost Zapper filly out of Seeking the Blue. And Grandview as well, $1 million colt by Into Mischief. So Into Mischief with two more $1 million plus, I mean, $2 million and a $1 million. Gunrunner with a pair as well, and then Justify and Ghost Zapper providing those fireworks. But then, they go down the move down from there. Obviously, when horses sell for $975,000, you had the Constitution that went to the Jacksons, Leal, the Avengers. They took home a Munnings Colt for $975,000 as well. I mentioned the Rigney purchase to start the night. Another big Not This Time, $950,000. Kerry Radcliffe signed. It was crazed. An average, they said last night and after the first night that it did seem like the average was going to be over $500,000, and it easily was, obviously. $533,000 average. The median was 4.25. So an unenviable set of numbers to, new benchmarks for the Fasic Tipton team to try to eclipse next year. So we'll get on his thoughts and I think it actually comes down to her, right? Isn't she the sales director and client relations manager, right? Yeah. So we'll see what Anna's got up her sleeve to try to top this insanity. These yearlings will move out, and I'm sure, by the way, that was just the gavel knocking last night, and this morning, don't forget, they're over on the grounds now. There's people combing the RNAs, and just to give you an idea, actually, it's interesting. I'm just looking down. There were 20 RNAs on Monday night and 20 last night, but then the cumulatives, 35 are listed now as not sold, which means five probably from Monday were sold privately afterward. And they get recorded if they're on the grounds and within what? Within 48 hours? 24 hours? I'll ask Anna that. What the, what private sale terms go in under the ledger through their system and are recorded as official sale. So there'll probably be a few more this morning. But everything that they could have anticipated and more. All right. Anna Seitz in about 5 or 8 minutes, give or take, after we kind of go through some of the top line news stories this morning. Let's touch on Virginia and the specter of the remnants of Hurricane Debbie, now Tropical Storm Debbie. Etc. After we wrapped up yesterday, word came from Colonial that they were shifting Thursday and Friday's cards to Monday and Tuesday, pell mell as they were. So the Thursday Friday action moves to Monday Tuesday. We will will await word this morning from Frank Hopf about how they're going to handle Million Day. And the initial feel yesterday was that they very well might have to move Saturday to Sunday. Frank this morning said that the forecast has improved. So there's probably a couple aspects of this. How much rain falls in and around Eastern Virginia and New Kent, and then, you know, how long it lingers, and they'll make that determination on the, obviously they want the turf. The turf can be yielding. I mean, it could even be soft for the racing, but they'll make that determination. I mean, the Carolinas and Georgia, a foot of rain, 12 inches of rain. You've seen some of the images. It's just nuts. Then there's, what is going to be the remnants of this thing heading toward, up the seaboard and toward Saratoga and including Saratoga. So there's already, plenty of angst about the weekend here and the storm's arrival and what it's going to mean to another, another weekend of turf. Particularly, not just at Saratoga, they've got the rescheduled Saratoga Derby and the Troy, but it's also Four Star Dave, a grade one turf mile, and the Galway. So there's four. If you haven't looked at the Saturday card, this is a challenge. Let's be honest. I'm just looking at the forecast. It looks like Friday is going to be the bigger problem as opposed to Saturday. So it looks like that today's going to be fabulous. It's gorgeous. We're off the turf, though. Too much rain too steadily yesterday that leaves us off the turf, and the Kaiser postponed again. So it's been tough for the Chase team. We'll catch up with Bill Gallo later this morning. I'm just looking, quarter of an inch tomorrow, and it's actually only calling for three quarters of an inch on Friday. So maybe we'll skirt this a little bit, and less than an inch on Saturday morning. 0.7 inch. So, all right, we'll just got to roll with this. There's no two ways about it. Dick Powell in a little bit this morning, and after we talk to Anna, and we'll go down to Florida. Sid got waylaid, it's been a very tough few weeks, and the travel aspect. Sid was already having a problem, and then his flights got knocked out by the storm to come up for the sale. So, one direction or another. So we'll check in with Sid and get his thoughts on what transpired and some of the trends. And, of course, Saturday and Sunday yet, you've got the New York Breds. So I started to say that the babies will ship out to their new homes all over the place, and the New York Breds will come in and set up shop and be ready, I suppose by tomorrow, right? Or even this afternoon, some will start to come in. In terms of the racing stuff we'll get to later with Seth, I think. All right. Yeah, there's no reason to dive into that. Really, although I do have a couple of results at some point that I have to at least revisit. Right, we didn't It's only Wednesday, so we're still, yeah, we still got, I still got some room. Notably, in fact, here, I'll do this before we reach for Anna. Mountaineer, Sunday night, if you didn't see what was going on, Brad Cox swept the stakes at Mountaineer on Sunday night. First, there was Hit Show, who was quite good. Did not go favored, actually. Extra Anejo, who just does not, I think they're going to have to turn back with Extra Anejo. It just does not seem like the route that he wants a route of ground. That's my determination. He's been the times he's gone long, the Haskell, the mile he ran at Ellis last year. I guess that's like the Wilson Chute mile, that dogleg mile. But the Hanschen, that's one turn actually too. But I don't know. It feels like this is a horse that Steve Asmussen will tinker with, and I think we're going to start seeing him at 7/8 and so forth. Just feels like the right thing, because he basically chased a 35-1 shot and had no answers when he was encountering mid-pack stalker closers. So Hit Show goes second choice, pays 480. Florent Giroux for the Wests. This is a Gary and Mary West homebred out of the lovely actress of theirs. And in fact, Sid does a lot of their matings. And then it was Dragoon Guard. Dragoon Guard follows up his Indiana Derby win with a West Virginia Derby win. So now a pair of grade threes for the Judmont homebred out of Philimby. And the Arrogate Colt, if he can continue to improve, he got a 91 buyer in here, and 97 buyer for Hit Show, but 97 for Dragoon Guard, 97 for Hit Show, and 91. For Dragoon Guard, which is basically what he's run his last three races, 91 in the allowance win, 92 at Indy, and now another 91. So he's going to have to probably ended up being a smart maneuver, waiting to take on the grade 1 3-year-olds. I imagine, how do they not run in the Pennsylvania Derby now? I think you have to, right? We'll see what next time we talk to Brad Cox. We'll see what Brad has to say. And I also, since we're grabbing some Sundays, and here, Brian, let me give you Anna's number so you can reel her in. And as we do that, we'll do that. Haven't had Anna on in too long, so this occurred to me that this would be nice. She had the whole team. Evan was on board, and the Pope, the son, at Laurel. Unfortunately, they ended up off the turf, and so the Searching Stake, those fillies, kind of wreaked havoc with that group, but it was Hammy Smith with the Leofric filly for Men's Grill. It happens to be a New York bred, Ronan Goddess. Won the Searching off the turf, kind of romped away actually, and Malibu Beauty. In the Caesar's Wish, this for Gary Capuano, and the partnership is ZWP and Nonstop Stables. Maryland bred by Buffum, the wonderful Buffum, 6-year-old Mayor. And where's my last? What did I do with the bald eagle? Yeah, this came off the turf. There it is. Cal Lynch for Runny Moore Racing. The hard-spun gelding. Give it a whirl. Wins the Bald Eagle Derby. So that was the Laurel action. And it was kind of too bad it came off. And on the Colonial front from Saturday, I haven't mentioned those two stakes for the juveniles. But Johnny Ortiz, and I you may have heard me on Monday make a reference to John Ortiz. It's really been a star-crossed few weeks. I mean, he's had the craziness of, you know, the horse with the wrong weight assignment having to scratch. He had the big, you know, Bright Work, the big filly, flip in the paddock the other day and have to scratch. Also had the big wins, including actually a Colonial in the Keswick for Dream Big Racing. And Not This Time filly, a May foal, makes a first start in the stake and romps under Ty Connor. This is a Virginia bred, and it's a Virginia. These two stakes were Virginia stakes, and it's just crazy. You know, we talked about Smitten Farm, and here's Ann Mudge Backer, Bill Backer's widow, and bred this filly. I mentioned last week about Smitten. And then there was Candy Crumbs, the Valiant Minister colt for Mary Leitner. She owns Florida bred, Shooting Star Thoroughbreds, Trevor McCarthy, 6-1 too. And Winfinity was 12-1. So two upsets in the two, and these were nice big fields too in the 2 2-year-old races at Colonial on Saturday. Anna Seitz, I think, is waiting in the wings.
Hello, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Yesterday you said it was starting to get to you, but it had to be pretty exhilarating.
It was, yes. It's a lot, but it was amazing. I think we're all kind of shell-shocked this morning. It's last year was amazing, and then to blow that out of the water, it was exceeded expectations. What a wild couple of nights.
I said the same thing, and you know, yesterday, you know, we were sitting with Boyd, and we had an extensive conversation, wide-ranging, too. But you just couldn't anticipate that the second night would be the equal or even beyond the opening night, and then to set all new marks. You know, I said it's going to fall to you for next year. The pressure will be on to try to match these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, the good thing is when there's so much success and so many graduates running well and so many nice horses, that it's easier to recruit the following year. So hopefully people will say, you know what, I want to sell all my top yearlings up in Saratoga.
Well, and that, right, you know, it's funny. We talk so much more about the buyers and we focus on the buying bench, but you bring up really a great point, making sure that,
Something
some of the best, right. I mean, that the breeders, you know, you instead of, I'm sure some would love to just stay home in Kentucky and wait for Keeneland.
Or October. The problem, you know, you have to have the right horse to come up here. You have to have, you know, a nice pedigree. You have to have like a perfectly, like a well-balanced, a good physical. You kind of just have to, it's expensive to come up here. So you've got to have the right horse. But when it works really well. And I think that's what we saw the last two nights is our consigners really and breeders really supported us with their best. And, you know, it's just, as Boyd always says, it's like a magical setting. Like you can't replicate it between the races, the town, the sales grounds, the horses, the buzz. It just works. It just all works together. It's pretty amazing.
You know, one thing I thought that was notable that, and you know, when you have a night like you did Monday, and you know, you get to the end of you know, of the first half of a sale, and there's people that end up getting shut out. I mean, that there were shortlisted,
so
right?
Yeah, totally.
So,
oh, no,
so
I got outbid. Come back.
Right. There'll be more tomorrow.
Exactly.
I almost asked Boyd yesterday, and then I we went on to something else. But I did want to ask him about Godolphin's. I won't call it a withdrawal. I don't think it's a withdrawal from these markets. It's more that their operation has kind of reached a more mature phase where, you know, they're producing a lot of their own merchandise.
Exactly. They are. And,
but they jumped in.
They sure did. They brought their team, and they were strong, and we really appreciate their support. It was great having them here. And I was just – I'm a big part of – I love studying the buyers. You know, I'm all in on the buyer recruiting, and just researching this morning – because people used to say Saratoga is not an international sale. Well, I just counted up 8 different countries, 8 different countries where we had buyers represented bought horses over the last 2 nights. So to me, that's pretty cool because it shows you it's not just Americans, it's not just the same buyers, it's people literally from all over the world, including new buyers, showing up, and everybody was going at it. So that's to me, when you have a really successful sale, when it's kind of spread out among 82 individual buyers, and you have a lot of happy sellers.
And I'm glad you went in that direction and brought that in, because I one of my favorite bear poking activities is to say, the rest of the world doesn't want our bloodstock, except that they do.
They do, and it's shifted. When I used to travel overseas, they used to say, no, we don't want to buy from the States, but now it's completely shifted, and it's a different, it's definitely changing. And I really noticed it in the Middle East when I was there in January, February. They really want these American horses. So, it's kind of shifted everywhere. We had a lot of Europeans here. We had Saudi presence. We had Qatar presence. We had Dubai, France, Ireland, England, Japan. So it's pretty special. So hopefully these horses, when you have success from the sale, hopefully these new ones will continue to have success and we'll just keep growing.
Well, you know, on that trip you mentioned, saw you dressed up a couple times, and I was a little, a lot of us got a little worried that, we might not see you again. Evan would have to hire the private detective to go find you.
I have to say that was the most incredible trip. Everyone was very nervous. Oh, you're a woman, you're going to the Middle East, and that it couldn't have been more wrong. Nothing to be nervous about. The hospitality in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Dubai, they could not have been nicer to me. And the reason I wore that dress was actually a Saudi prince who had bought horses from Paige's Kitchen bought it for me because I kept saying how much I admired how beautiful the women's outfits were. And so he said he bought me that dress to wear the Saudi Cup. And I felt obviously very uncomfortable because it was not something I would normally wear, the veil and the long dress. But the reception I got, because that's what they like, was really, really cool. So my entire trip was absolutely outstanding from the second I landed to the second I left. We were there for 10 days. And then they showed up in Maryland and they spent more than $5 million with us. And then they came to July and they went in that crazy bidding war over Informed Patriot. So they have repaid us instantly. It was very nice to see. They really want our horses. They needed a little push, I think, just to kind of know, like, what is Phasic Tipton? What are your different sales? Which ones are yearling sales? And, obviously we have the only two-year-old dirt sale here. So just educating them and even getting a couple of them here to Saratoga for the first time. So it's all about, Bupat Timar was here, leading trainer in Dubai. He was bidding away. He said, man, this is wild. He said, next year I'm coming back with more money. But normally they like to buy ready-made race horses. So to get them to try to buy yearlings, to me, that was a big plus for Phasic Tipton.
Well, and in addition, when you have that, as part of the, part of the resource from a sales side, then when you look at our domestic buyers and just looking at last night, Speedway, Mandy Pope, John Stewart with the Resolute situation, the Jacksons, Grandview,
Mr. Rigney. Rigney's. Oh yeah, it was great. It was just like you said, we could go through all of them, like all across the board. It wasn't just a handful; it was spread out. You know, I mean, like I said, 82 individual buyers. So,
well, we certainly got a note. I'm talking about these individual outfits. Mrs. Weber with a very big two nights.
Yes, she sure did. She's been just such a great supporter of Phasic Kitchen all these years. We love having her here at the sale, and you know, we love when she shows up. And you know, she's just like a staple here. So for me, it's special. It's great to have new people, but to continue to see faces that have been supporting Phasic Kitchen for all these years, that makes it even more special. I think, you know, we love our current existing customers. You know, they're the ones that keep us going year after year after year. So we love Mrs. Weber.
Well, and I'm just looking, she spent just under $3 million and bought six hips. And clearly, the Broodmare band getting some attention, four fillies and two colts. She bought a Vekoma filly, a Mackenzie filly, a Spitestown filly, and an Into Mischief filly, and then a Good Magic colt and a Gunrunner colt. And you know, basically in her sweet spot range, basically $500,000 each, essentially.
Yeah, she's very strong. Oh, it's crazy. It was just crazy. I mean, it was just one after the next. It was just like, wow. It was fireworks after fireworks. Pretty fun. We have a lot of fired Phasic Kitchen employees this morning.
Well, you don't have a lot of time to recoup.
No. They're already cleaning. These horses are shipping out. These guys are cleaning these stalls. They're getting ready for all this New York bread coming in.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, and because it's such a high-level sale, we don't really think as much about the pinhookers. But when you look through the middle, you know, these days, when you look through the middle portion of, right? You know, here's, for instance, here's an essential quality filly, hip 218, 200,000, Hartley Dorenzo. You know, you'll see there's plenty of that. Here's Dave Scanlon, bought a Bolt Doro colt, 250,000. So there were plenty of pinhookers that Dave, 320 for an essential quality colt.
You know what else I like to see, too? All the trainers that show up at the sale. You know, we love our horse trainers. There's so many great ones that have been. They're just such a huge, our core customers of Phasic Kitchen, a big part of, you know, all of our sales. But to see so many of them really hustling to raise money to buy horses at this sale, I thought that was pretty spectacular. You know, just, you know, trainers from all over the country coming and working hard to buy horses, and pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Good job. Good job, Anna. You're going to have to beat the bushes
Don't worry. I'm sure we'll have it starting already for next year. I'm pretty sure we already have started on, you know, we'll have a meeting of what can we do differently? What can we do better? How can we, you know, get even more good horses like this for next year? What didn't work? You know, we'll always be trying to fine tune and, you know, some of our teams already, you know, we have a big digital sale coming up, so our team's starting on getting those horses entered for the next digital sale. You know, we showed that complexity share, which went really well. So working on the November sale, but we're hustling. We're trying, Steve.
Well, this was somehow better than even anticipated, and congratulations to everybody, all the consigners, all the buyers, and of course the Phasic Tipton team, Anna Seitz.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. We just appreciate so much everyone supporting this sale on both ends, because it takes an army, and when it comes together like this, it was pretty amazing. So thank you, Steve. There'll be some celebrating
Not
around
at
here,
all.
That's for sure.
Well, I do need to know, is can we still use the number two at the snack bar? I overheard Boyd.
If my children haven't eaten all the candy and put it on the Fabic kitchen tab, he steals my kids, takes them over to the snack bar, buys them junk, and then hands them back to me to deal with the sugar high. I'm like, thanks, boy.
Well, if anybody needs, you know, a BLT later, number two, tell the girls behind the counter, number two, and it'll be on Anna.
Now I'm gonna have
Anna,
to go
thanks so much.
Now. Thank you. Steve,
yeah, I think
you.
Yeah. I love it.
We look forward to seeing you at the sale, the New York Road sale, and I'm sure I'll see you at the racetrack.
You bet. Anna Seitz, everybody, and the Fasig Tipton first round, and just an incredible home run. We'll get some more details and insights from Sid, and I'm still waiting for Nicole Russo, who had said Wednesday, but waiting for her. Dick Powell, I think, is standing by, though. Dick, good morning.
Dave, good morning. Waiting for the after Dr. Palmer on Monday. Now I have even more doubts in my mind about what's going to happen and how it's going to be. Because if we get 2 to 4 inches of rain, this new system they've put in is going to get their acid test.
What were your impressions, and was there anything in there that that either surprised you? I mean, you monitor track scenarios, you know, very closely, and you really are the go-to for me on this topic, you know, in terms of history and you know the observations. Is there anything that that you think was incomplete about this concept, and what was your overall thought?
Well, I thought it was great that he was able to go on a farm where he had time, not rushed. He could speak in depth on anything he wanted to. You steered him, prodded him, got him to expand things even more. So what I like is I like reading source material. I don't like reading what someone says about something. I'd rather read the something and make my own decision. So here you went to the horse's mouth. You had Dr. Palmer. He was intimately involved, especially last Saturday, with the decision to cancel and postpone the 2 stake races. And he went through the process. Now, my questions were, Not really questions, but you can't cover everything, and I'd love to have some time to ask him these things, is usage. That we're talking about turf and we're talking about moisture content, and I never heard usage come up as something that needs to be tracked. So last year, when you talked to jockeys, they were climbing, there were holes all over the turf course. And that's from not only usage, but usage when the course is soft and the hooves go in farther and create bigger holes that don't fill in as quickly and are harder to get back to normal. So we move rails around because we don't want one part of the track to get too much usage. But then overall, is usage being tracked in terms of literally, how many hoof prints have been out there? We have an 8-horse field going 5.5 furlongs. That might not be as bad as 10 going a mile and 16th. Going around twice, they're hitting every portion of the course. The turf sprints don't really race on the clubhouse turn. So I thought usage was something that will need to be addressed in their model, that a turf course, even a high moisture turf course, may be perfectly safe in the beginning of the meet, but then as the meet goes on, that may or may not be the case. The one thing I had texted you was on Saturday, I have never seen a day where it stopped raining around 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. It never rained again the rest of the day. And yet all 13 races were either muddy sealed or sloppy sealed. That track was sealed the entire day. Now, in my mind, I'm leaning towards maybe that's a good thing, that by keeping it that way, you kept it consistent. As he said, when you seal it, you keep the moisture in. When you open it up in Harris, you're letting it dry out. The question is how uniformly does it dry out? His big point was consistency of the racing surface, no matter what surface it is. So having the sealed track all day, number one, might have been a tremendous benefit. Number two, I, as a handicapper, have no problem with that. My problem as a handicapper is when they announce the track is fast, and anyone with two eyes can see it's not fast. The horses are coming back covered with mud, and it was just a premature designation that, it was listed as fast, but it really wasn't. And he covered how Japan lists their tracks on a number in terms of moisture content. Australia lists their tracks from 1 to 10 in terms of how deep the track is. France uses a penetrometer, which gives you exact rating of how far the penetrometer goes in. Farther it goes in, the softer the surface. Hong Kong does both. You can get the penetrometer reading every night, but then they have a listing of good or good to firm, things like that. So it sounded like that was going to change, and that track conditions were going to be much more scientific as far as how they're designated, which, as handicappers, that's fantastic for us, because at least we're getting an honest appraisal of what the racing surface was, be it dirt or turf. So listening to him, listening to the process, raises questions for me. Okay, under these circumstances, this is what you decided to do. What do we do if we get similar circumstances or even worse circumstances? So this week, now, the last forecast I had on at the 9 o'clock news locally was 2 to 4 inches in most of the viewing area. And that's not Saratoga specific, but there's going to be not just storms, but rain that's going to accumulate. So then they have to look at their data, their sensors that they have in both courses, and see where they are. I thought it was interesting his point about how the moisture content in the home stretch was about 25% higher than the back stretch. That was interesting, and that might mean something in terms of the breakdowns, which is what he was mapping from last year. But I think obviously it's a learning process for everyone. And he readily admits it's a learning process for him and what they're doing. So I thought it was just informative, thought-provoking. But, you had to sit and I went back and listened to the whole thing again, just to make sure I didn't miss anything or didn't misinterpret it. And that horse who went down Sunday morning might have been a heart attack. I don't know for sure. But it wasn't the Gaming Commission website that the horse was put down on the main track Sunday morning. But he did complete his workout.
Yeah.
So I don't know precisely what happened on that. And he did kind of agree with me that the most challenging part of the racing surface is that change from wet to dry. Drying out steel track can be the most challenging. I call it the most dangerous. Didn't address, and nor should he. My theory is not that my nuance is I have nothing against steel track. In fact, I didn't mind them keeping that track sealed all day Saturday. It would be as horse players, it would kind of be nice to know that they're going to do that because you're playing pick fives and things like that into future races. But they did it. The surface held up. But the issue is after they seal it and it's drying out, there is this rush to get the fast. And getting the fast, number one, is misleading because it's not a fast track. Number two, I don't think they harrow deep enough. I think that track needs to be turned over pretty deep and let it dry that way. And that means you're not going to have a fast track. You're going to have a good track, and it's going to be wet, and it's going to stay wet for a while. And there's nothing wrong with that, especially if that's the safer way, because in my mind, harrowing it deeper gets rid of some of the soft spots or, you know, patches where the footing is inconsistent. That's you're turning over just about the entire cushion, not just the top. So I think he painted a very broad picture of where they are. He kind of indicated Saturday they were late because it took that long to get the data. He thought that process would quicken up some. But, you know, I get it. It's safety first. And as you said, if this is the way it's going to be, this is the way it's going to be, complaining about it. If anything, if you're a handicapper, you just have to adjust to it. You got to learn it. You got to understand it. And you have to adjust. If you don't adjust in anything, sports betting, this, you have no shot. So we'll see what happens this weekend. They've already failed on poor jumper. Steve.
Yeah.
Those people are no one. And then I see what Colonial's doing in anticipation and things like that. So I just thought that the word I would use, besides education, two words, educational and sobering, that there was no emotion. It was scientific, technical. Yes, there's some subjective parts to it, but he wants to have the scientific, technical in the forefront for them to make decisions.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great for you and for this, you know, at the races show that I don't know anyone else could have given him that forum. I don't know anyone else that he would be comfortable enough to speak that way. And I think racing gained a lot on Monday because after a bad weekend, we got a lot of answers.
Well, and I appreciate that Dr. Palmer, he kind of buttonholed me on Saturday after the Whitney, and the minute he started to talk about, you know, the process, I said, oh, this is, you know, we got to get, you know, we have to get this communicated because certainly the horse player community, the stakeholder community, and the fans, need to understand the process that is going to influence these decisions. When it comes to, you know, Colonial, obviously, for tomorrow and Friday, I mean, that was fairly easy for them. They know this thing is going to come through and even if the forecast is better than it was 24 hours earlier, they know there's going to be a lot of rain, and you know you're not going to run cards, especially there because of, you know, how turf oriented they are. But for us, it's a little different, and it's a little more nuanced because of, you know, the nature of the storms that we get here. A lot of rain and short bursts. This scenario is a little different. But I just thought it was amazing and learned some things that didn't know existed. In fact, I'm trying to go back. Hold on, I'm going to go back to what I, because I sent that. Here it is. From Monday. that he explained, a box and whisker plot. And I put up, yeah, I put, there it is. For those that didn't see it on Monday, I put up a schematic of what a and I'd never heard that term before, a box and whisker plot.
My follow-up would be, if, well, let's say we're talking dirt and we have measurements. Now, at one point, it sounded like they have 5 pieces of equipment, 6 to 9 inches below the surface, taking these measurements. So that's pretty spread out. So my question is, you have a moisture level, but you don't have a compaction level. So you could have the same amount of moisture, and the track could have been sealed and hard as a rock. The track could have been opened up and loose as could be, getting sun and drying out. And I didn't see where that moisture level was being affected by track maintenance, at least in a short period of time. So obviously, if you're opening the track up and letting it dry and stuff, yeah, the moisture level is going to go down. How quickly does that happen, seeing how far below the surface it is? So I don't know how they're going to do the compaction part, with the sealing part. And part of it Saturday, it didn't look like he was sealing the track that hard. It wasn't like that picture I sent you with that machine. That wasn't out there. It was just a tractor dragging the plates and smoothing it out and keeping a smooth, consistent surface. So maybe that's going to be our future. Maybe that's going to be when we have wet tracks, they'll do that and then obviously try to dry it out. And if you had a couple of turf races coming up and you're going to have an hour and a half before the next dirt race, maybe you could hire it then, let the sun work on it, maybe seal it back before the race, just things like that all seem to be on the table at this point. So I think whatever we're looking at is in a process of change, and I'm sure you'll have them on again, have more questions for them. I'm sure you'll have more data and answers.
Well, thanks, Dick. I appreciate it. I got to ask about the feature, certainly, on Saturday. And got to clearly have a new handicap division star. I must admit, I was amused. Everybody was looking forward to the Whitney, and then they run the Whitney, and one of the refrains I've seen is, it ended up being a crappy race there. These horses really weren't any good. It's like, it's just amazing. there is no level of satisfying. I don't get it. It's pretty funny.
Well, it was an odd race in the sense that the narrative that was available during the week was, he probably would be one of the horses to come out if the track was wet.
That's right.
But the track was wet and sealed. And with his speed and with the game plan from Junior to gun him and Skippy, caught a horse out of the gate, and Flavian didn't do that. He used his natural speed to get up there, but the minute they really put the pedal down, he was content to sit back, and I just, if I have one criticism of Flavian, believe me, not a big criticism, but sometimes he rides dirt races like the turf races. So in a turf race, take him back, sit third or fourth in the pocket, that's great on turf. That's not so great on dirt, especially if you're getting dirt kicked in your face for a mile and a half for a horse that's usually used to being on the lead and not having anything kicked in his face. So he got out sprinted early, and the winner was just brilliant. did not bounce. And my problem with his last race was not so much his last race, but I didn't see anything that was a foundation for that race. You know, that race, in my mind, really popped up. So he's more likely to bounce, but he didn't. And now that he's shown that he can do it again, I don't know if he's surface dependent, whether he needs that kind of grip to run his best race, but he was fantastic. And you know, you can excuse National Treasure, you can excuse a lot of them. Kruppi just was amazing because he was up against everything. And he's still battling through the lane and passing horses and covered with wet dirt all over him. He was game as could be. And you know, there were others that they ran well. It was just it wasn't so much the outcome was shocking, but the flow of the race for me was surprising because I expect the National Treasure to be first or second early. He wasn't, and now the race just takes on a whole new aura, especially on a track that still was sealed and still seemed to be carrying speed.
Well, that group will scatter a little bit to the winds. We've got Jockey Club Gold Cup. We've got, in fact, I saw an ad this morning, and I guess it was that in TV. No, was that it was in the Saratoga Special for the California Cup as well. You know, all the preps toward Breeders' Cup. It's certainly welcome to have a new fresh face like this at that level, you know, and a 110, you know, a 110 buyer, that's racehorse figure.
Oh, it was no fluke, and him being a big flashy gray, he's gonna be a fun horse for the public to follow right through the Breeders' Cup.
Well, Dick, a couple other thoughts. We probably should hit a little Presque Isle too. You know, Brad Cox. I just was talking about Brad Cox at Mountaineer in the Governors and the West Virginia Derby, and then on Monday also won the Lady Erie the stake up at Presque Isle too.
Yep, and Brad. Brad has terrific staff, and when you have terrific staff, you're able to shift and go anywhere and no problems. And his staff is terrific, and they're able to do what they do all over the East Coast and all that. So no surprise on that. Today we have our 8-race card. And I did like that point you were making. Yes, I think it was Michael Dickinson. But, you know, the beta horses can come back 17 to 21
yep.
days and you get
yep.
more races out of them. And if you had a bigger horse population, you'd have much, much bigger field. I'm going to get bold here, Stevie, and we're going to do a pick four. And it's going to start in race five. We're going to go 2-7. Jenny Lind, lots and lots of gold, and race five. Race six, going to go Detroit City, who's 1-for-1 over the course, and Noble John, who is also 1-for-1 over the course, and he just was tremendous. His first time on Speeda, he wins by 4. He shipped in from Penn into turf sprinting. So he's a dirt horse, he's a turf sprinter, and now he gets on Tapita. He beats open allowance horses by 4.5. Now he drops down to 25. So he looks like he has these at his mercy. So we'll go 1-4 in the second leg, race 6. Race 7, we're going to go with Grounded, number 2, who is 9-for-19 at Prescott, including a Gate to Wire win last time out, a very fast time. Going a 1.70 against this optional 40 group. So that's number 2, Grounded. And then I had to throw in number 7, Hemaquid Pete, number seven for John Fantasy. He's won 13 times at Prescott. So these horses are just the poster boys for racing at Prescott. They race. He's 8 years old. He earned $64,000 last year. He already has $30,000 in the bank this year off of three starts and just keeps running and running. He'll be running right through October, and age eight, still out there doing great and running back every 2-3 weeks. So race seven, we're going to go 2-7. And then in race eight, we're going to go number three, Ransour. From a train I'm not familiar with, Joe Massaro, but he's had a good meet. He just has not big numbers in terms of quantity of numbers, but he won at Presque Isle by four, came back on two turns and tied. Now he's back to the right distance. So I think three and eight, Governor Atwood, will be the last place. So 2-7 with 1-4, with 2-7, with 3-8. And the races today are, I found them really interesting. They just lots of little old timers. There's a nice state bred maiden race in race number two. So we'll see how that works out. And no Pablo Morales. I don't know if Pablo, I'm not sure why. But he does not have mounts today. So we still have the leading rider, Antonio Gallardo, and he's there. He won't be there. Well, usually he's at Colonial, but Colonial is not racing tomorrow, correct? They move Thursday to, what they do, Thursday to Monday?
Thursday, Monday.
Yeah. So, well, I see now that's going to be interesting because Gallardo now has a choice to make between Prescott next Monday or Colonial next Monday. So he goes back and forth. It works out very well for him. And he's having a terrific meet at all the tracks that he races at. And something came up one day, Steve, that just popped in my head. There was an interview with Joe Moreira, who was always Hong Kong's leading rider, or him
sure.
and Zach fighting it out of the year. And he's still trying to get a license in Japan. And there was some reason why. I know he's had some health issues. I don't know if he had hip replacement. But Joe's still out there. And every once in a while, we see him pop up in a big stake race. Vincent Ho, one of Hong Kong's leading local riders, was in Germany the other day. I think he was second in the pre-Diana, the German version of the pre-Diana. So just seeing the international flavor all over the place. But as you said, no one wants to buy our horses anymore. I love that one.
It's just amazing, and that anybody would try to continue to beat that drum. It's a litmus test for nonsense, essentially, because it's just 100% wrong, and it was wrong. It was wrong even when they were pretending that it was right, and you know. When they were using it, for those that don't recall, this was all part of the Lasix gambit, essentially. If we stop using Lasix, the rest of the world will then they'll covet our bloodstock. They were coveting our bloodstock anyway. It's preposterous.
And YouTube. I was on YouTube. That's how I watched the sale last night. And there were these collection of YouTube videos. So one of them is Songbird, 9.5 million, Half the Grass, 10 million. And it shows the auction when they got sold. And every one of these mares that they had raced on Lasix. There's none of them said, and they did it without Big Bad Lasix. They all raced on Lasix. They all sold for gigantic money.
Dick, you got anything for – you got a Saratoga play today, by the way, while we're
– Yeah, I did work last night, and then not knowing what the weather was going to be, so I kind of held off a little bit. Let me quickly go through. Race 7, which is a dirt sprint, 6 furlongs, number 3 on the ledge.
On the ledge.
Had been in maiden special. Bruce dropped him down to maiden claim. No, not Bruce. I'm sorry. Michelle Nevin dropped down to maiden claim off the layoff. And Kendrick was aboard 1x9. Bruce Brown claimed it. Kendrick's back. It was a fast track, so it wasn't a wet track. And he has a number on Brist. His second career start was just as good as that last race. So the last race is not as fluky as it might appear. Yes, he was 4-5. Yes, he's meeting winners today. He's 6-1 morning line. I'll take 3-1 on him. But on the ledge of race 7, I'm going to try to single in any of the horizontals later in the card.
Yeah, we should have. Give it another, I don't know, give it another 20 minutes. And one thing that, you know, for those of you that are looking for scratches as early as possible to help you with your, you know, your decision making and ticket building, the Naira Betts is getting them up even before Andy tweets them. So check Naira Betts first. You'll pretty quickly you'll get them there. That's where I've been checking most readily. There's a lot of MTOs. Today too, yep. And that fourth race, the fourth race, there's five MTOs. There's three MTOs in the ninth, and I can tell you at least one thing. In the ninth, I happened to reach out to Rob Atrus because I was curious if he was running both of his horses. Bounteous, the five, is staying in with Santana, and is actually a pretty darn competent dirt horse. And then he is going to have the 8-5 favorite, Bearings, and he's got Kendrick Carmouche to ride. There had been no boy on Bearings, but it'll be Carmouche for Bearings, the 11, and Bounteous stays in for Rob Atrus.
And if Wesley Ward stays in race 5, which is the first sprint with number one Sunday Shoes,
yeah,
I think he could be tough because there's one dirt race he showed real good speed right there to the stretch, and then back on synthetic. But I like especially to heat it to dirt. And, you know, he's been training up here on turf, so I'm sure Wesley was dying to get him into this turf sprint. But he stays in. I like his pedigree, and his one dirt race was okay. And at 5-1, you know, I'll take a shot.
Well, and there's actually quite a few horses that are going to stay in. The 5, Unsung Melody, I think, and the 6, Speedy Traveler. They both seem logical to stay in. Even the Elm Street Lady from Brittany Russell. And then, of course, there's the MTO, Linda Rice, who, you know, is the smartest trainer in the room entering MTOs. She's also got a cool operator in the 4th, but doesn't have as much of a look in there. So, Dick, I appreciate it, and we will see you out there this week, and good luck.
Okay, Steve, thanks.
I appreciate it. Dick Powell, everybody. Sid Fernando standing by in Tampa, and you know what? I hadn't even seen how the hurricane, how Debbie, I think it was more on the East Coast, but I'm sure Tampa got its share. I will mention that our friend Brad Morgan sent the NOAA weather map that is pretty foreboding in terms of the path of this thing, literally traveling over Albany. I mean, like literally between. I mean, it could not be more direct. Good morning, Sid.
Good morning, Steve. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Yeah, you're kind of light.
Brian, what can you do for? Can you?
But that's fine. I can hear you, but
yeah,
it's not as vibrant as usual.
We'll work on that. Sid, the sale, I don't even know what to say. It's one thing to have a vibrant sale. Then it's another thing in the teeth of, you know, a little bit of a market correction that sometimes spooks buyers. this sale just was insane.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, yeah, I'm sure you've talked to all the beat writers about it, but it was. I mean, what was there, like $20 million horses in here? I mean, 12?
12, yeah. 12, 6 and 6.
Yeah. Yeah. $12 million horses. I mean, you know, obviously, Resolute Bloodstock was a big player. They bought 3 out of the 12. So, you know, you've got some new money at the top, and, you know, you also had Zidane very active at that, obviously, with that $3.4 million horse. Yeah, it's some of the same people. You know, you had the Coolmore Peter Brandt partnership buying 2 out of the 12, and then Godolphin bought $1 million horse. I was talking to a client, and I said, you know, the sale is just so small. It's showcased in a very elite venue. It all leads to, you know, fireworks, really, and that's what happened.
We'll go through some of the specifics. You know, one thing that came up with Boyd Browning yesterday, and then without me even prompting, Anna Seitz this morning also, you know, dove into the international buying bench. And, you know, there's, you and I have talked about this, Sid, in different, you know, in several different guises. But, you know, here's Ammo Racing, who operates at a high level internationally, a $500,000 Yaupin colt, a $900,000 Not This Time colt, and a $525,000 Mattoli filly. And they, you know, they're going to start to race on these shores. There's more and more, you know, international outfits are landing here. I'd love you to talk about that a little bit, and then, you know, what it offers or portends for the breeding side and them keeping mares in the U.S. And then I thought the Godolphin storyline and your long-term observation of how they've operated. They jumped in yesterday for $1 million Justify colt, and you know we don't get Godolphin Coolmore bidding wars like we used to, but it sure seems to me like Godolphin has reached a certain maturity level in their, you know, in their development curve, and more of the Godolphin runners I see are all homebreds.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they have such a huge broodmare band, and they're standing stallions, and you're going to get more homebreds when an operation like theirs has been so mature for so long. But they're not averse to coming in and buying yearlings here and there, as I've showed. I think what you said about Ammo was really interesting. Kerry Radcliffe, another international buyer, signed one for $950. I don't know who this Flying Dutchman is, to tell you the truth.
Well, we got that yesterday. I got the details from Jessica Martini, or was it Boyd? I think it was Jessica. It's the Dutch Brothers Coffee people that had been signing tickets and racing under board shorts.
Yeah, sure. Interesting. So they're buying under Flying Dutchman. You know, that's a newer entity at the higher end, too. You know, don't forget, he's the guy who bought that the first share that was offered in Flightline.
Flightline, yep.
That record-breaking share. course, he raced his board short stable, and so he's that's good work there finding that. And of course, you know, you've got a lot of your mainstays too. Live Oak, a couple of $500 million yearlings right there. You've got China Horse Club back in partnership with Windstar and Sienna Farm buying. Spendthrift is buying. You know, it's good. It was good. Obviously, Rapoli. Very good group of buyers. You know, Renato, I mean, Ramiro Restrepo bought a $650,000 Uncle Mo. Ramiro, of course, was one of the partners in Mage. So, a big, diverse group of buyers, including foreign entities. Shadwell, I noticed, had one for $450. I think Rapoli really stepped up his game here too, didn't he?
Well, and he
Resolute and Rapoli buying kind of fueled quite a bit of it too.
Well, and also there was like a obviously if the average being 500,000 plus 535, and when you look at those prices, yeah, there's clearly a sweet spot. In fact, I brought it up with Anna Seitz. Mrs. Weber basically bought six for $500,000, essentially.
Right.
Here's China Horse Club with Sienna Farm and with Windstar, the Maverick Racing. They bought a 525 Uncle Mo. They bought a 425 McLean's Music. There's sort of a nice. They're really it's hard to identify 500,000 as the middle market, but there really did seem to be a lot of that. Here's Rich Santulli, Colt's Neck, a $400,000 McLean's Music Colt, and how about a $300,000 Midnight Loot Philly for Colt's Neck. We should mention, you know, because we did have a conversation near the end of the show yesterday. Aaron Wellman joined us, and Eclipse, along with the Malones and with sometimes with Bob LaPenta, sometimes without, but Eclipse, a $400,000 Gunrunner Colt, a $520,000 Practical Joke Philly, and then a $610,000 Not This Time Philly yesterday after we talked. You mentioned Flying Dutchman, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hips, as much as the $1.5 million Tappet out of Mopetism. You know, your friends at Don Alberto, they had a terrific sale from their side of the ledger.
Yeah, and I think, it just struck me that the Baffert buying bench was stronger here than in previous years as well. Not only with the Dan, but the Avengers group of SF, you know, Matikit, Starlight, they bought quite a few as well. Seemed like they were buying more here than, I could be wrong, but it's just anecdotally that's what it seems like to me.
No, I think you're right. I want to, in addition to that side of it, let's talk, as we all often do, Sid. Let's talk about the stallions and some of those indices. And it was pretty obvious after Monday that Charlatan, continues to be in huge demand.
Yeah, I mean, first crop stallion. You know, top racehorse at the Wright Farm, Hillendale. great bloodlines, and really, just as importantly, Stone Street bred horse. And Stone Street bred horses, Stone Street horses, whenever they're involved with them, they tend to be excellent stallions. It doesn't matter the price range, apparently, because just think about it, you know, just off the top, you know, obviously they control Curlin, but McLean's Music, who is a sire of Complexity, who they also bred, and a share in Complexity sold for $510,000, which was pretty huge. You know, that's going to put Complexity at the moment, the leading freshman sire, that's going to put him at this moment next year in the $50,000 to $75,000 stud range, based on that share price. And in fact, your listeners might be interested in a piece that Francis Caron just wrote,
just posted
this morning,
right,
on Complexity.
Yep.
Because Complexity kind of ties in with what you're talking about too, the global thing.
Yep.
He's got 3 stakes winners, 2 graded winners. One of them, Black Forza, is a Group 2 winner in Europe, which is huge, especially for this dirt horse, this dirt speed horse. That horse's success in Europe is just going to fuel even more interest in the horse. I was talking to Jason Louch yesterday, in fact, he's been, you know, owns half of Not This Time, who at the Sail Topper, obviously, and we're talking about Not This Time's accomplishments, and I said the last frontier for Not This Time is to have that top horse in Europe. And that's what, when you can get the American sires to start doing that, that attracts even more interest in U.S. stallions. And Complexity share price of 510 done so well here, but that European Group 2 winner kind of takes him to a different level. He's had good winners in Japan, all over the place, as Francis points out in her article. But the fact that somebody took a chance, Pinhook Day, American-bred Complexity with a dirt background, Pinhook, that horse is a 2-year-old breeze-up horse in Europe, brought good money, I think 220,000 pounds, and is now a Group 2 winner. That really opens the eyes of people, especially Europeans. Forget about Lasix. Forget about how bad the U.S. bloodstock is. They're coming here for that. And something like that can only create more interest across all price ranges, too, because, you know, pinhookers are not going to be shy now about taking an American dirt speed horse like that and transferring him to Europe to resell.
Couple of interesting results too off the ledger. Here's I referenced Charlatan. The there were 3 that came out. There was 1 RNA, but 6 of there were basically 6 of the 7 offered sold. 375, 150, 550, 1.5 million, 500, and 630,000. I'll tell you who had a very notable start. How about Essential Quality? Look at this, Sid. 6 for 6, or 5 for 5. Yeah, 5 for 5. 450,000, 500,000, 510, 200, 320.
Excellent.
Right? You know what's interesting? I see Dave Scanlon bought one. That's obviously a pinhook. And Hartley Dorenzo bought one. So when you've got Hartley Dorenzo and Dave Scanlon buying your yearlings for those kinds of numbers, they're expecting that these are 2-year-old in training horses that are going to sell north of of $750,000 next year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I thought it's also a good sign that, you know, those type of pinhookers would focus on a classic Sonny Tappet, and a Sonny Tappet that's a, you know, a stretchier, more classic looking type of horse, not, you know, not a speedy looking horse. So that's a really good indication of what this horse is bringing to the table.
The big engines on the train, I mean, no surprise with the Into Mischiefs and the Gun Runners and the Justifies, they absolutely met expectation. Here's a very quiet, sort of in the same vein of essential quality. Maxfield had three in the sale, and they sell for $335,000, Sweet 16 stables. Kerry Fromer bought one for Mrs. Charles, for Hillwood, $300,000. And there's that Shadwell you talked about.
$450,000.
Very strong introduction for Maxfield.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you look at the leading sale sires here from the sale, you get a mixture, and this is important for people to kind of parse. You know, you've got obviously some really well-performed classic stallions, like classic type stallions like Gunrunner, Curlin. You've got proven classic sires like Tappet, Into Mischief, obviously, emerging ones like Constitution. But look at Not This Time. You know, he's only a grade three winner, only raced at two, only made four starts. And he's the type of stallion that, you know, most people poo-poo these days on social media chatter. If a horse like that were to go to studs, you know, there's always, what's he doing going to studs? No soundness, no, yada, yada, yada. But he's performing, isn't he? So it's very difficult to very difficult to criticize a stallion on its own race record sometimes until years later when you can actually evaluate how well that horse has done.
Well, and speaking of on that topic, right, and you want to delve into the Not This Time conversation?
Didn't I just speak about him?
Yes, I mean, in terms of, because you saw, I'm sure you saw Tony Kovitz, Tony wrote, he picked out specifically the $3.4 million sale topper. When he wrote it, it was more or less about the session topper. But, I mean, you go down this list, $150,000, $300,000, $3.4 million, $600,000, $900,000, $300,000, $950,000, $500,000, $750,000, $610,000. Those are all the Not This Time. There was one early on Monday, there was that HIP 11, $1,075,000 RNA. Other than that, and actually there were also late in the sale, there were two RNAs, a $150,000 and a $240,000 RNA, the last two HIPs, 237 and 239, right at the end of the sale. Essentially, you know, Tony was picking out Case Ace and her production record, not so much, and I suppose production record is directly tied to soundness, right? I mean, it's not just a question of horses, you know, getting babies that aren't fast.
I mean, people pay these kinds of prices, and it's certainly no guarantee of success. My point only is that a horse like Not This Time, and full disclosure, because I'm going to be biased on this, but we did the mating of Not This Time for Alba.
Right. That's right.
So I happen to be especially pleased of this horse's success at stud, his as well as the other half brother, Liam Smap. Of course, you know, as I was talking to Jason yesterday, we were, you know, they were so upset in hindsight after they sold Liam's Map, you know, for $800,000, he became a grade one winner and went to stud and started doing well. The reason that horse is called Not This Time is because he and his father-in-law said, not this time. They're not going to sell this horse. And so the horse got named Not This Time. They kept him. He didn't have the same race record as his half-brother, Liam's Map. Showed a lot of potential, obviously. He was second in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Went to stud in a bold move. They kept a lot, you know, more than half of the horse. TaylorMade, to their credit, you know, wanted to stand the horse. And when you stand a horse like this and he hits, and we've talked about this several times on your show, on this show, you know, he gets top sprinters. He's got the staying horse right now next. He's got top two-year-olds. He's got grass horses, grass sprinters. And he gets classic horses like Epicenter. So he is actually a huge positive for the gene pool, despite having only made four starts, because of the diversity of aptitudes he brings to the table. It's rare for a stallion to be able to do that, to be able to get the wide range of racing aptitudes. Only exceptional stallions can do that, and he appears to be an exceptional stallion. He's being rewarded right now, or the breeders who bred to him and are selling these yearlings, they're being rewarded in this very hyper-driven sale where you're paying premium plus. The price is obviously to most people, and you know, obviously $3.4 million is a lot of money, but it's what the market is. You know, obviously to pay $3.4 million, there's somebody else underneath that. It's what the market is naturally pricing these horses at. Now, are they all going to go and do stuff? I don't know. Historically, a lot of these expensive horses don't. I mean, it's tough to ask anybody who picks a horse to say we're going to pick, you know, 10 stakes winners out of 10 foals. No, it doesn't happen that way. But the stallion is drawing a lot of interest because of his versatility, because of the fact that he's hiring a lot of high-class horses. And in today's environment, you know, that he has kind of risen to that top echelon of stallion. And so he's still pretty young. He's got even better mares down the pipeline, because don't forget, he only started at like 15,000 and then, you know, dropped down to like 12,500 and stuff. So, you know, the thinking is, Steve, that he's even got better horses coming if you base it on the quality of mares. And quality of mares frequently, mostly, dictates how well a stallion will do. And if you've got an exceptional stallion, as a frequently used quote of John Secura's, that can flip the light switch on, end quote, then you've got that type of stallion with really good mares, and you're going to get what's, you know, potentially some really top crops coming down the road. So when people do spend this kind of money on colts, they're looking at residual value of the stallion. You know, say they buy 10, they're really only expecting one of that 10 might be the one that floats the boat. And, you know, you look at this $510,000 share in complexity. Well, that was for 2.5% of the horse. So that's one share in a 40-share syndicate. That would, you know, put that value of that horse right now in the $20 million range. So, you know, this is the kind of speculation that people are playing. It's a game that ordinary people can scoff at, and rightly so, because that's a lot of money. But to the guys playing this game, it's like wildcatting for oil. And, you know, if they hit, you know, if they hit a gusher, that's what they're looking for. You know, a lot of these people, Steve, at the high end, they're, you know, they're not looking to have a horse that, as admirable as it is for most of us, makes, you know, 50 starts and becomes a listed stakes winner and races till he's six. They're not looking for that. They're looking for a classic type of horse that can win a grade one, win a classic, and eventually go to stud and pay for everything else. If they get two, that's even bigger, right? So that's we have to understand the types of games that, or the types of business models, I should say, that people are utilizing in this highly speculative industry of trying to find the stallion right now as a yearling. And again, to use other sports is very comparable. For example, when MLB teams will draft a high school player,
right,
for exorbitant money, while more quote-unquote proven college players will sign for less because they're looking for a potential superstar. And so that's just how professional sports, baseball, basketball, football, you know, everything gets scouted younger. And so what these syndicates are doing right now is they're trying to find stallion prospects. The old model, a horse races, he wins his races, then he gets syndicated. These days, the syndication process starts right at the yearling. 10 guys get together, we're going to pay whatever. Let's get this horse, you know. If they hit, boom. If they don't, they've hedged their bets with buying 10 horses for those 10 guys, instead of one guy paying the entire load for one horse. So the hedges that, you know, he could put all his eggs in one basket, lose and lose the whole enchilada, or he could put his eggs in 10 baskets and perhaps one wins and he's got a percentage of that horse. So that's the, you know, that's the real thing. Now, Zidane is different. He's just paying huge money. He's the one who bought the $3.4 million thing. But look at the success he's had. Astounding, really. A limited number of colts. And, you know, seems like every year one of those colts becomes a grade one winner and goes to stud for a lot of money.
And I'm glad you went into this, you know, into this direction, because part of yesterday's conversation veered into, actually, there was kind of a part A and part B, and if anybody missed it from yesterday, you can catch up on the archive or the, you know, the pod subscriptions. And Craig Burnick addressed this, said, and then later Len Green and Aaron Wellman, and, you know, kind of drove home the point that it's important that, certainly from the partnership side, when it came to Aaron, you know, particularly, that, you know, the enjoyment factor, the pleasure of the competition landscape needs to be the priority, and while, you know, there's you know, you can understand, you know, those that are treating these purchases as, you know, speculative investments. I mean, and you bring up a great point. I do see, you know, comments about, you know, how the industry trumpets, you know, these unproven sires, you know, as successes, you know, without, you know, really any evidence other than the price tag. But the priority, you know, does need to be the pleasure of the competition and you know, the excitement of, you know, pitting your horses against others.
Well, they're all sportsmen and they love racing, and I'm sure, you know, that's a huge factor in it. You know, the more horses that you can have a part of and the more racing you can participate in is certainly really attractive. You go, you know, I'm sure you go to the track with friends of yours and, you know, you get a lot of exposure to races if you have 10 horses as opposed to one. And you get to share that thing with your friends and all that. Sure, that's all. That's great. But, you know, ultimately, you're hoping, certainly in this climate, you know, no matter what anybody says, nobody wants to walk away with loss after loss after loss.
You
know?
No.
So you put together teams that give you the best chance to succeed. Getting back to the Zidane thing, since he's kind of unique and paying this kind of money on his own, he's had tremendous success. I don't think he's going to be coming back year after year after year. You know, he spends $10 million every year and loses. Same way, let's take a look at the partnership group, the Avengers, the SF Starlight Madicat group, and all their things. Yeah, they love to go racing, but I'm sure winning is huge to them, as it would be to anybody in this game. Racing is a competitive sport, so you want to win. You also want, especially with these newer types of owners, there's a transition to commercial versus pure sporting has taken place. These are bottom line guys, and they're interested in, you know, cashing some stallion deals as well. So, you know, let's put it all together. It's not a bad thing, but it's not, say, Paul Mellon breeding his own horses, racing them, doesn't go to the Derby if he doesn't think he's got a shot, and has the immense wealth, as did many of that era, to take losses without blinking an eye. We don't have that type of owner anymore on a large scale. And so, you know, it's a societal shift in how business is conducted in general. And, you know, I recently read an excellent book, just to diverge for a second. It's called, and I recommend it to anyone, it's called Madness Under the Royal Palm by Lawrence Lehmer. And it's about Palm Beach society and the evolution of Palm Beach society. And for a long time, the Palm Beach society, even though Palm Beach historically attracted WASPs as well as Jews, it was controlled by the WASP aristocracy, and they were very exclusive. They had inherited wealth, and they had clubs like the B&T and the Everglades that were only for WASP members. But as time evolved and businesses, entrepreneurs arrived, a lot of the Jewish clientele ended up having more money the lots were living on, you know, this aristocratic image without the money to back them up. And things started to shift. And that example is very apropos to racing. The old-time gentleman sporting, very wealthy, WASP patrician owner has gone by the wayside, and more industrious, entrepreneur, more individuals that are making money in their first generation are appearing on the scene, and they are attracted to racing because it stands for that class that had been established by societal mores. And so that's a big shift, and it kind of explains really what's happened in racing too. The Phippses, the Mellons, the Galbraiths, any number of them, the Whitneys, have kind of disappeared. And you have the Seth Klarmans, the Mike Rapolis, the SF Bloodstock Group, and what do these people come from? They come from money-making endeavors, and they're drawn to the sport because of its historic nature, but they also have a bottom-line incentive that the old-time WASP ownership group didn't have. And so that has changed the game into a more commercial proposition. So are we going to really try to change every part of racing when it's a naturally progressing thing? Yes, we may not like some of the stuff that's happening, but it's a societal move.
That's right. That was great. That was great, Sid. It's so funny because year after year, when in whatever arena and compartment that we discuss, it's so easy to essentially, you know, make a direct correlation to society at large, and how racing is a microcosm, and the people that are kicking the cat and wringing their hands over directions that the game has taken, they're pretty shocking. I mean, they must be oblivious to the forces around them that shape our world.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because it's the forces around us that are shaping everything. So it's very difficult to say, for example, well, a pitcher isn't, he's not getting his 200 innings every year, and we used to have, 50 guys 50 years ago, and now we got 3, and we need to change that. Well, I mean, it's nice to try and change it, but forces have occurred for this to happen. One is that guys are throwing harder. They're throwing harder earlier. They're leading. There's more surgery. In the case of hitters getting better, there's so many forces in play that dictate what's happening. So that to isolate one little thing and say, oh, we need to get these guys to pitch 200 innings a year is almost virtually impossible. It's almost like saying, we need more soundness now, but who's going to do it, Steve?
Well, and it's not as if certain outfits haven't tried. I mean, you got to give Brad Kelly and Calumet a lot of credit for trying that direction and making the old-fashioned solid stamina-type stallions available.
Except they weren't commercial.
Exactly.
And it's very difficult to do that in a commercial marketplace.
Exactly.
That's the surrounding forces that you're trying to work against.
Yep, 100%.
You know, so listen, I'm very sympathetic to everybody that has cogent views on this, but I'm also very cognizant of forces around us. So if everybody wants soundness, why do they then go to read the volatile, you know, I'm not saying the sources are sound or anything, but, you know, somebody talks about, oh, we want soundness in the business and business. And then when it's up to them to put their money on the table, they go to a speed horse with six starts.
Exactly.
So they can sell the yearling in the first crop of that sire. So there's talking from one side of the mouth and doing from the other.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's very convenient if you have a soapbox and you can talk about it. I'm not talking about Tony here. I'm just saying to people in general. Tony's stuff I find very interesting. I feel bad for Tony because he beats the drum. And he's got a lot of valid points. But, you know, pray tell who is going to do it.
Who will bell the cat?
I used this example before in dog sports, IGP, the top dog sport. You know, German Shepherd used to be dominant in it, but Malinois are now because they're quicker, faster. Their working dog lines have been preserved better, and they have great bite. And the Shepherds, I likened to my previous example as the WASP group that have deteriorated, the benevolent, wealthy sporting group, and the Malinois are the new breed. They're coming in, they're hungry, they got all this yada, 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 boom, 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 and they're winning, okay? And so are you going to tell a guy in dog sports, no, keep going with your German Shepherd and get clobbered by the Malinois? No, that guy's going to want to get a Malinois. Because if you're in it, why are you going to get clobbered?
100%. No, these are all fabulous examples, Sid. I love it. Between the
And I would sympathize with somebody who said, yeah, we need the better shepherds. Let's go get them. But who's going to do it, Steve?
Yep. No, I don't entirely necessarily agree that there's evidence per se. You know, what was the John Nehrud? It takes seven crops before you're going to make a determination about a stallion's success and influence. So even the early results aren't telling the whole story, and you've laid out examples before of the stallion that didn't have a complete career, but is getting progeny that are sound as can be, and have sustained careers if that's what they're. You know, their owners and their conditioners, you know, want from them. There's too much conclusions. There are too many conclusions drawn from incomplete pictures. And the conclusions are drawn with such authority, declarations that then have a potential to taint a certain sire or sire line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's true. But again, the forces of nature that we're working with right now dictate that, because it's all commercial, that if that new sire, that first start sire, doesn't hit with his two-year-old and certainly doesn't hit with the first half of his three-year-old crop, he's not going to get any mares. So because it's commercially driven, the next year, when they're four, he's not drawing any mares. he's got to be sold to Korea. So it shortens the commercial aspects, have shortened everybody's timeline. So, for example, getting back to Nehru's example, ordinarily in his case, when he was talking seven jobs, he's talking about stallions with a book of, say, let's be generous and say 100 mares, although it was probably lower. That's yep. 700 mares, okay, over 7 years, say 700 foals over 7 years. Well, now, horses are breeding 200, it's double that. The shelf life is now 3 years, 3.5 years. So everything gets shortened. It's just like people used to read long form articles in the New Yorker. Now they peruse short posts on Twitter because it's easier sound bite. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying everything gets shorter, everything gets quicker. The incentive for somebody to say, getting back to my German Shepherds, hey, you know what? I'm going to start breeding German Shepherds, and I'm going to compete against the Malinois. That's fantastic. But that person's got to spend years, again, building up that Shepherd, spend a lot of his money to try to do it, and in the interim, suffer years of losing. And so that's my point is, who is going to do it? People are going to the winners now.
Yeah.
Right away, you know?
100%. Yeah. Sid, outstanding. John Sakura is going to join us after the break, and we'll get John's take. He just got back to Kentucky minutes ago. So, Sid, I appreciate it. This was great, as always.
I'm looking forward to hearing John. See ya.
Sid Fernando, everybody, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale and the patriarch of Hill and Dale will join us next. In conversation here with Frank Hoff at Colonial, they will have, it seems, a decision about Saturday, whether they're going to go ahead and maybe they even delay the decision, but there'll be a decision about the decision probably in the next hour. So if it comes while we're on the air, we'll pass it along. Whether the million card runs on Saturday or whether they push it back 24 hours to Sunday. So keeping an eye on that. The scratches are out for Saratoga. And as I sort of speculated, the card pretty much stayed intact. Excuse me. The fourth. 1, 2, 3, 4. We got 6 in the fourth. And 5 in the fifth. And actually, 2 healthy scratches out of the stake, out of the Johnstone, including Cupid's Heart, who Bruce Levine had 3 in there. And interestingly, he leaves Sunset Louise. We had that fun conversation with Bruce. Oh, I did not. I got to put up the link to the Loose on the Lead show. We'll talk to Seth in a little bit. So 5 in the stake in the Johnstone. And in the nightcap, it ends up with the 3 MTOs, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Still a 9-horse field in the ninth. That's interesting. There were 10 horses with an entry, so there were 9 betting interests. There were 9 betting interests if it stayed on turf, and there's 9 betting interests off the turf because the entry came out as it happens. So, yeah, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah. 9-horse field in the ninth. So cards stayed together pretty good. My handicapping was done, and it actually didn't get impacted too much. I made Backstretch Rose the DePaula play of the day. I thought she had a nice look in that non-winners of 2 lifetime for 25. Comes back to that level. McPeak and Leparoo in the sixth race. What else is notable here? One horse came out of the third, no big deal. One out of the sixth, Blenheim Baby. Stormquist came out of the seventh. Fighting Back came out of the third. It's all right. It's going to be a good day. It's gorgeous. Certainly a gorgeous day. Take the only break of the morning. We'll come back. John Sikora, Hill and Dale, Seth Merrow ahead as well, and more. Hour 3 at the races. Sirius XM back after this.